WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
Michael Shannon is an Oscar-nominated actor known for his movies like The Shape of Water, Revolutionary Road, and even his role as General Zod in Man of Steel. Now he's enjoying the view behind the camera as he makes his directorial debut in the new film Eric LaRue. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. The new film, Eric LaRue, tells the story of Janice, the mother of a teenage boy who shot and killed three of his classmates. And we watch as she tries to cope with the fallout.
When Eric was seven, we took a trip to Leech Lake.
That must have been nice. Were there leeches in the lake?
Yes. Eric had some between his toes.
Wait, Eric was bleeding?
Why are you asking me that? What does him bleeding have to do with—
Stop. I've made you angry.
I'm not!
Eric LaRue is an adaptation of Brett's 2002 play. Brett kicked things off with what he thinks the big screen offers to the storytelling that perhaps the stage didn't.
The interesting thing when working on an adaptation of a play is that all of the stuff that you talk about in rehearsal, like where was this character before, where are they going, who are they related to, what are their friends, what are they doing, what are their jobs, we get to put that on the screen. We get to widen the town. We get to meet more people. The pressure on our lead character becomes greater as a result. There's more people sort of setting up obstacles for her. And that's what happened with the adaptation for sure.
Mm-hmm. And you both have deep ties to Illinois, Brett, and the film also takes place here. Why did you feel that that was the setting that this story needed?
I grew up in Iowa and have lived in the Chicagoland area for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And I haven't written too many things outside of Illinois and Iowa. A couple of things written to take place in Louisiana, but that's where my dad's from. So it's all in the family, I would say. And the way that I write and the things that I talk about, even just the language that is running through my head, the dialogue, I can't help it, just the way I hear the world. And so it just ends up being here outside of here. It doesn't seem to work for me.
Yeah. Michael, did the Illinois connection, did that make it seem like an even better fit for you?
Oh, gee, you know, I definitely appreciate Brett's Midwesternness in his voice, in his writing, for sure. But I definitely... on a macro level, I think was one of my ambitions was having a kind of subcutaneous discussion about America at large.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. About how, what a confusing country this is to live in and how dysfunctional our society seems to be in all corners of the country.
Yeah.
But you always, even in a situation like that, where you're trying to express a broader subject like that, you have to focus on you do that best by focusing on a specific community. So this definitely seemed to make sense to that, because, you know, a lot of what's in the script and what Brett's writing about is drawn on experiences and people from his own past.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this is a heavy topic that unfortunately hits close for a lot of Americans. Right now.
Exactly.
Did you have concerns then, Michael, about going into this project, about sensitivity issues, or whether you would get pushback of any kind?
Well, I think the concerns would arise if we were proclaiming to have some answers or instructions on how to deal with the situation, which we're not, you know. There are no directives in our film, you know, like do this, do that. It's just an exploration, really. So anybody who wants to take umbrage with an exploration, that's on them, you know. I don't feel like any particular anxiety about it. I think it's very honest. I think it's very authentic. And honesty and authenticity can be intimidating, I suppose, to certain people, mm-hmm. particularly in this country. But I'm not scared of them.
Brett, what was this like back in 2002, highlighting the school shooting subject on stage?
Oddly, I mean, where it was produced at A Red Orchid Theater, this is sort of in line with everything I'd seen before at Red Orchid and everything that I've seen after. And I've been an ensemble member since 2004, not soon after it was produced. And so our audiences were prepped for this kind of material. How it plays to the larger sort of cinema crowd, I don't know. I don't really think about it. Like I said, with my writing and just the dialogue and everything like that, I don't know what any other way to approach things. If it doesn't challenge me as a writer, then I'm just not interested. Mm. I have the story and the characters. That's interesting to me, but it's mostly the people. I'm interested on to what happens to people when outside forces corrupt their lives, and powerful outside forces corrupt their lives, and how they react, respond, are lifted up, are destroyed. All of those things I grew up with, and I just don't. If there's no way I can hamstring myself, I just have to just present it at face value.
Right.
If people don't want to participate, I can't force them. And but I'll be there. I'll show up for the game.
Yeah. Michael, this feels like a big shift for you. Was directing always the goal?
Oh, no, not really. I had directed some theater. I mean, the whole reason this came about is it was closing night of a play that Brett had written called Traitor that I had directed. And I was at the closing. I came into town for the closing night. And Brett handed me the screenplay at the closing. And I remembered Eric LaRue from seeing it back in 2002. I wasn't involved with that production at all. I just was an audience member. I went to see it quite a few times, actually, because I was fascinated by it. Mm. Brett gave me the screenplay, and it was like a magic trick or something. I was reading it, and it just was forming in my mind. I could see it. I could feel it. I was like, oh, I know who should play this part. I know who should play that part. Oh, I know what this looks like. I know what that, you know.
Interesting.
And yeah, it was not something I anticipated in any way, shape, or form. It wasn't something I was looking for. I frankly think Brett was kind of shocked when I said to him afterwards that I wanted to direct it. Is that true?
I was shocked. Yeah, I give stuff to Mike, and I do this all the time. I think I probably sent him something not long ago at all. I need a few things for Michael, and it's just the first thing is just when he sends me a text that just says, "Oh, I really dig this. Wow, this is great." That's kind of
let's do
where
something
it begins. Yeah, and I will take that because we've had worked together so much. We have a lot of the same interests, aesthetics, and if Mike likes it, then I know I'm onto something.
Right.
And with no, like, will you be in this, make this, help me with this, nothing like that. And it was in that same sort of mindset that I handed it to him, just like, hey, can you look at this? Because it was the first play I adapted into a screenplay. And I'd been teaching screenwriting at Northwestern for a while, and I was like, well, I should probably
work on
writing these. Yeah, and I'd written one or two.
Practice what you preach.
Yeah, practice what I preach. I really felt that way. Actually, I felt a lot of pressure on myself from that. Yeah. I'm like, what am I doing? And I'd written some other stuff, but nothing that I'd really tried to do, and I got some feedback from my manager on it, and this was actually her idea to write it at all, and I handed it to Mike with just I just wanted to see if it was a thing. A few weeks later, he texted me saying, "I think I might want to direct this," and I was like, "What?"
Yeah, that must have been a shock for sure.
And also, we had just worked together, and I love working with him so much. It's my dream scenario also always to be in the room or on set working with Michael. It's a blast, and we really dig into it, and it's my favorite artistic collaboration. It really is.
That's wonderful. And so, Michael, this was just, you know, not the dream, but something, a particular project that you were interested in and wanted to take on. But once you decided that this was going to happen and you had the conversation with Brett, did you say, okay, now I've officially put on my director's hat. I've got to go to some of my favorite directors in the business and get advice? Or were you thinking that it was more important to just dive into this all on your own? How did you approach it?
Yeah, that's interesting. So there's chapters to that. You know, when I started prep was the most foreign thing to me. That was the thing I had never experienced. I mean, as an actor, you do your preparation largely by yourself, you know, if you're doing research or just studying your script. But a director's prep process, you actually need to be collaborating with a lot of your artists and designers and your DP, and you're having conversations. That's where I felt kind of in the weeds a little bit. I talked to a director that I've worked with a couple of times, who I really respect and admire, because I genuinely wanted his input on how to go about this. And he said, look, just sit down with your DP, pick out some of your favorite scenes from some of your favorite movies, and have him or her do the same thing. And then you say, oh, let's see this shot and this scene. Well, maybe we could get something like that in our movie or this scene, you know. And as he was saying this, I thought, oh, I'm not going to do that. That sounds terrible. I don't want my movie to just be filled with a bunch of my favorite shots from other movies that have already been made. I want to make my own movie. So then something kind of switched on inside of my mind where I was like, oh, it's okay to do this. You don't have to have a license or anything. You can just kind of do it. Because I realized that, much like when I read the screenplay that first time, it was all kind of laying dormant in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I could see it. I could see what I wanted and how I wanted to do it. I say the filmmaker I'm largely influenced by is, unfortunately, a filmmaker I never actually got to work with, David Lynch. But mm-hmm. we did shoot in Wilmington, North Carolina, which is where Mr. Lynch made Blue Velvet.
Oh, nice. So
some kismet there, yeah.
Michael, we've got actor Judy Greer starring in this film, and we've talked to Judy on Reset before. Once again, she does a stellar job, you know, in a piece. Like, she's depicting the struggle here that the main character, Janice, is dealing with. You know, she mm-hmm. is the mother of this child who has committed a very serious crime. She's trying to move forward within her community and at her job, and she's also dealing with anger and frustration. Walk us through some of the conversations you had on set regarding how she should best portray Janice.
One of the reasons I wanted to cast Judy in the first place is because I was very interested in the idea of having somebody in this role who was not accustomed to being in such a role. Like, I didn't want to go to the usual list of suspects for, you know, high drama, you know, people that are used to crying a lot and getting a trophy and moving on with their lives. I wanted somebody who actually would come at it not just from a sense of, oh, this is a deeply emotional experience, which of course it is, but the thing I really appreciate about Judy, she's actually quite cerebral. She's a very astute, she has a very astute mind. She's very intelligent and she's very concerned about the world and how things are going down. She's mm-hmm. a very conscientious person. So I wanted to capitalize on that. But,
interesting.
You know, when we got to the final scene, which I try not to say too much about just because I don't want to give it away. But when we got to the final scene, which is obviously a big frickin' scene, and she just came in that morning. She's like, Mike, I don't I don't know what to do. And I said, no, of course you don't know what to do. How could you know what to do? Just, it's kind of like what Pastor Steve says in the movie, saying you're ready would imply that you, how's it go, Brett? You already know the outcome, that you're, it's
a beautiful line. I'm not know my lines.
Yeah.
It's true, Mike, that there's a lot of answers. And we did this all the time. The answers are often in the script. And I think that comes from some either a conscious rule that I try to apply, and I tell my students too. It's like, if they put you have a question, put it in the script. Somebody will ask that question, so put it in the script. So that question that Steve asked, she says how he said, when you're ready, and well, how could anyone be ready? Which is a question that probably I either asked myself or somebody asked. It's like, well, have him ask the question, and so then that ends up being something that leads.
You know, Brett, I want your thoughts on Judy's performance here. This is huge, her role. And as the original writer, I wonder if that's satisfying, seeing an actor just kind of knock a character that you created out of the park.
Yeah. The answer to your question is, of course, it's satisfying. It's great. As Mike said, Judy is an incredible person. Her ability is insurmountable. And I'll say, though, that character, Janice, has been in my life for over 25 years.
That's right.
And when we did it in Royal Shakespeare, however long ago that was, the show that Dominic Cook directed, Leah Williams, who played Janice, was fantastic and had struck me so much that my daughter is named Leah.
Oh my goodness.
So it's odd. This doesn't happen with everything I write, but this piece has been a part of my life for such a long time that I'm often thinking about Janice, and to have Judy playing that part. I met her the first day I met her. I knew that I'd have a friend for the rest of my life. And she's great.
That's wonderful.
And Brett had the privilege, I mean, not the privilege, but Brett was on set every day, which doesn't always happen with the screenwriter. So Brett was actually, and I think the reason I wanted to bring that up is I think that was Judy, part of what Judy was able to accomplish was being able to have Brett around and have access to you that way, I think really boosted her a lot.
Mm-hmm. And vice versa too. I mean, we would go out every night and talk about the show. It felt like doing a show at Red Orchid. It felt like after you rehearsal, you go and you talk about it some more, even though you just talked about it for 6 hours. Go talk about it some more.
You know, I wanted to ask about the pacing of the film too, because that stood out to me throughout. And I don't have anything to compare it to. I did not see the play, but it was slower than I had imagined it would be. Just sort of where we start the story from, learning more about Janice and getting just sort of tiny bits of what happened with her son, Eric. And then, of course, you know, all of this leads us to that final really big scene that Michael alluded to earlier. But was that intentional, just kind of to keep it slow moving?
The play is like that too. Yeah. I think it's one of the things that Michael and I synced up with, but I always think of Janice as underwater, that she's drowning. And when I saw this last time, I really had a sense of that. And I don't think anything that I've ever said to Michael before, I don't ever think I've said underwater to you before, but this last time I was really like that feeling of how to communicate while you're drowning or when you're underwater. Is such a strong part of it.
Interesting.
I'm always hesitant to take credit for much of anything regarding directing this movie, but the one thing I will say is that the rhythm of this movie is engineered by me. And you can ask my poor editor, Mike Selman. The rhythm, because I'm such a musical person, like music is actually my favorite thing. And so the musicality and the rhythm of the story was was super important to me to get that. I don't know, but then again, you're talking to a guy, one of my favorite movies is Into Great Silence, which is a 3-hour documentary about monks who can't talk. So
okay,
I don't mind silence. I actually think silence is really important. I actually think a lot more gets said in silence than in conversation sometimes.
Well, I'm glad you brought up music because I know you sing, Michael, and you perform, and play guitar and I believe the piano. I'm not sure on that.
A little bit.
So, yeah. You know, actor of stage and film, director. What's next? Are you going for film composer? Maybe?
Geez, Louise. Well, I have such an extraordinary composer on this film, Jonathan Mastro. I would love to collaborate with him again, actually. But gosh, writing music, it's such a... I have so much respect for it. I have so much respect for writers in general. I think it's the one thing that intimidates me, whether it's writing music or writing a script. That's why when I find people like Brett and Jonathan, I hold them close, because without them, I wouldn't have much to do.
Yeah.
But it's funny. I just turned 50 and I finally actually genuinely feel grateful to be alive. So I'm just so excited to keep exploring, you know, the world. And there's so many people right now that are down in the dumps, and I get it, because there's a lot of crazy stuff happening in the world right now. But I just wake up every morning and I'm like, bring it on.
Grateful.
I love it. Yeah. Grateful. Yeah.
Well, before we let you go, Brett, give us your best pitch. Why should people go and see this film?
Oh, boy. Well, I think it's about engaging with these lives. One thing that Michael talks about is, you know, you may think it's a play about, or excuse me, a film about a school shooting or some other tragedy or something happening in the Midwest. But Michael has always said this. He said this from the start, that it's about everything. I know that's a lot of weight to put on film, but my favorite films feel that way, that they're about so much more than as they're presented, or they give them circumstances mm-hmm. of what's presented. And I want people to come and feel what it means to just sort of deal with the crap that life throws at you. And the people who are trying to help, people are trying to hurt, possibly them all being the same people, and how you end up managing. I mean, and like Michael said, the everything is... in such a, I hate to use the word flux because it doesn't feel like as deep enough as what's happening. But I feel like people are really interested in understanding how they're feeling right now. And
yeah.
The entire movie, Janice keeps saying this. I want to know how I'm supposed to feel.
Mm-hmm.
And not that we're providing answers about that, but I feel like people want to have that conversation.
Yeah, it's relatable.
It's relatable. Yeah. The people can relate to it, which is... you know, you would think about with how the subject matter is perceived that maybe not. But I know that we're all exposed to violence, gun violence, questions about faith, things in our lives, the story of how we're meant to go on. And I feel like it this one is that. It's cinema. So the scale is big.
Yeah.
And so us there with it, that's what I want. Let's have that conversation.
Yeah.
That's screenwriter Brett Nevue and actor and now director Michael Shannon. Their new film, Eric LaRue, is out now. Michael and Brett, thank you so much for joining us.
Patrick, thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Meha Ahmed and me, Sasha Ann Simons. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Ari Mejia. To stay connected, make sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening. We'll meet again tomorrow.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.